The information in this podcast is alleged and based on our understanding and research at the time of recording. We make every effort to ensure the accuracy of the information presented, but we cannot guarantee that all data is entirely accurate or complete. The opinions expressed herein are solely those of the hosts and do not necessarily reflect the views of any organizations mentioned. Listeners are encouraged to conduct further research and consult professionals before making decisions based on any information provided in this podcast. For further information and full case files, including crime scene photos and case reports, please go to the link in our show notes. Viewer discretion is advised. Previously on The Stack Deck.
To fully comprehend how it even be possible for David to be a victim of foul play and have oil poured over him, you need to fully understand how vulnerable and defenseless David was when in psychosis.
He called and said, oh, my parents wanted to come over. I said, okay, well, can you just ask them to wait until I'm there? Upstairs, and as I get to the door, I can hear some voices. You know, I walk in, and I was like, oh, I didn't think you guys, you know, were getting here until later. Like, I was pretty upset. And so at that point, I thought he had just gotten drunk. From the time he got home until then.
Sure.
And when this happens in the past, I normally would try to get his attention. I'd snap him in the face, grab his face, look at me, what did you drink? What did you take? You know, what's going on? His parents really didn't like that I did that.
Did David ever talk about his visit with his parents and that he needed to a break from your relationship and wanted to move home?
He did talk about his visit with his parents. He did not mention directly that he wanted a break from our relationship. He talked very briefly about moving home with his parents, but it, again, was very brief.
When was that conversation?
I'm not sure. I don't remember.
Welcome back to the Stack Deck podcast series, episode 4, The Medical Examiner's Office. I don't believe most people think of the term conspiracy when they think of medical examiners, but maybe they should. In a New York Times article by Sheila Diwan entitled Failed Autopsy, False Arrests, A Risk of Bias in Death Examinations, Ms. Diwan raises serious questions about disastrous errors made by medical examiners and whether these errors are influenced by prejudgments and a close relationship with the police. The fact that two pathologists concluded that David's death was suicide has been a major obstacle, if not the biggest obstacle, in trying to get journalists to consider anything different. While Hennepin County may have believed assigning two pathologists to David's case would squelch any questioning of their conclusions, when their intentional omissions were discovered, their seemingly ironclad credibility just went out the window. When you factor in the Hennepin County's chief medical examiner's own criteria for conducting an autopsy on a suspicious death, instead of being conclusive, I believe their conclusions are instead criminal. Similar to police officers, medical examiners have qualified immunity. In other words, they can make egregious errors, but as long as they are not intentional, something that would obstruct prosecution, they are scot-free. Recently, however, in a significant qualified immunity ruling, U.S. Court of Appeals denied dismissing a civil rights case based upon qualified immunity. This decision was based on intentional suppression of exculpatory evidence, which sent an innocent man to prison for 17 years. As you would imagine, there is a strict criteria for conducting an autopsy in a suspicious death case. Here is how Hennepin County Chief Medical Examiner Andrew Baker describes the autopsy process when questioned during the George Floyd case. Quote, We start every exam with a very thorough external exam of the decedent's body in an as-in condition. Then we examine the body again from head to toe, front and back. We document this with copious photographs as we go. When I use the term robust data set, what I really mean is I have dictated the most detailed autopsy report that I can, describing all the scars, all the tattoos, all the birthmarks, all the injuries. My goal is to create a set of photos that are so robust that another pathologist could take my set of photos and almost feel like they have been there for the autopsy. That person has enough data and can reach their own conclusions. They don't have to take my word for it because it's in the photos.
And Dr. Baker, is the autopsy part of a broader death investigation?
Yes, the autopsy is just one piece of the medical examiner's death investigation.
And could you generally characterize the umbrella? What's the death investigation entail overall?
So the medical examiner's ultimate mission, in addition to properly identifying people, is to ascertain their cause of death and their manner of death. The autopsy is just one component of that. It obviously has a great deal to do to inform the cause of death and manner of death. But we also need to know the decedent's past medical history. We need to get a hold of the decedent's next of kin to see if the decedent could potentially be a donor. If there's any family history that we need to know about, we will typically contact decedent's primary care physicians as well as get their hospital records. If an ambulance was dispatched and took them to the hospital, we'll even get the ambulance run sheet as part of our investigation. Because to get the cause and manner of death right, you need to assemble all of those things for the whole picture.
So let's go back to the autopsy aspect of it. How important is it to have a detailed documentation of what you do?
In terms of the autopsy?
Yes, sir.
Well, it's critically important that the autopsy be very detailed, particularly if the death is potentially a homicide, because obviously it could end up in a court and the work that you're doing would be evidence.
And do you create what we might refer to as a robust data set documenting what you do?
Yes.
What's all included in that?
So when I use the term robust data set, what I really mean is I have dictated the most detailed autopsy report that I can, describing all the scars, all the tattoos, all the birthmarks, all the injuries. In many cases, it's the pertinent negatives, meaning the lack of injury, places where you might expect to see an injury, but you don't. All of those things are very carefully dictated in a narrative autopsy report. But that's not enough. You have to take copious photography as well. My goal is to create a set of photos that's so robust that another pathologist could take my set of photos and almost feel like they'd been there for the autopsy. That person has enough data that they could look at my work and reach their own conclusions. They don't have to take my word for it because it's in the photos.
Of course, this is what most people would assume when thinking about a medical examiner conducting an autopsy: clinical, objective, empirical, right? Now let's compare David's autopsy report to Dr. Baker's robust data set criteria. Starting with the external examination, here are a few things worth noting from Hennepin County's two pathologists, Dr. Quinn and Dr. Jackson. It is noted that David's body arrived in a blue plastic pouch. That rigor was fixed in his jaw. The majority of his head hair is singed, except up to 2 centimeters in length on the posterior scalp. It is noted that there is scant pubic hair present. A yellow-green chalky substance is on the anterior left and posterior right thighs, aka fire extinguisher residue from when the maintenance worker sprayed David. Here they note the substance, but no follow-up with the maintenance worker. They note that there is a 4.5 centimeter scar on the anterior left shin. 2 hospital identification tags labeled with the decedent's name and medical record number. Under thermal injury, here are a few of the 2 pathologists' notations. Diffuse partial thickness burns involve greater than 90% of the total body surface. There is extensive skin exfoliation, partial degloving of the hands, and marbling of the veins of the posterior hands, and note that forearms. In order to conduct the internal autopsy examination, David's heart, brain, lungs, liver, kidneys, spleen, and pancreas were all removed, examined, and weighed. Essentially, they gutted my son, and yet they missed the most conspicuous and concerning area on David's body, the perfectly horizontal protected area on both of David's wrists, which was the only place on David's body that was not burned. No notations, no commentary, no nothing. Is this a coincidence or conspiracy?
My question for you is, how do we go about, is it possible to have this change from suicide? Because you said, well, it's based upon the reports that come in. Well, it's based upon two things then. One, he refused to come out of the apartment, and as a pathologist, you can say, well, I can understand why he didn't come out. The guy was mortally wounded. And then the other reason to determine that it was suicide primarily is she said that. I mean, obviously, right. You say, well, he was in a mental hospital. He had oil. He was naked. He had oil poured all over him. How did she pull that off? But, you know, as you know, and I'm trying to be concise and not domineering here, but as you know, probably, it's not uncommon for a person in psychosis to strip naked. And David did that when we insisted on a drug test the night that we got him into the hospital. He ended up down on his hands and knees, and his wife was aggressively slapping him until my wife screamed at her, and she said, well, it's worked before.
So I would say, you know, you're right in the sense that how we determine suicide, you know, we talked about this, how we got there, you know, that is how we got there with supposed eyewitness accounts and, you know, the story as we're told. And you're doing the right thing in terms of bringing the county attorney on board and having them look into it and go back, get the records. And you know, when I see their interpretation, which is theoretically unbiased, you know, and sure, it agrees what you've been saying and what they've found, I don't know what the new investigative leads are, but, you know, like when I last spoke to Mr. Harris, it was they were waiting for the phone record. So it sounds like they've moved forward with that a little bit, and they're, I don't know, wherever they're at. But once I get their input, and if it supports that undetermined change in what you're saying, you know, that kind of thing, then we make the change. I mean, that's when it would happen. Okay. You know, I would bring it to my group here and show them, but presumably, you know, if it's all showing that the single witness is not reliable that way, et cetera, you know what I mean, that we're not comfortable now saying this is how it played out, then we would make that change.
Sure, and the single witness you're saying is his wife.
Presumably, I can't remember exactly, you know, she's the main source of information for sure, you know, without going back and just looking at the case again, but...
In closing here, let me ask you this. Is there any way, with kind of fresh eyes as you go back and look at this, to say, you know, to determine of any position David was in, you know, why, like, his feet seem to be severely burned. If he was standing up, I wouldn't think that his feet, I mean, although I can understand that if there's a ball of flame and oil everywhere, but, you know, to re-examine this and say, is there any indication of what position he was in? Where is there any indication of, you know, did the flames go up? Did the flames go down? You know, was he on his back? Was he on his hands and knees? You know, why is his hands so, appear to be probably in the most rough shape?
I'm just reviewing the picture one more time.
Sure. Do you think David was able to see, you know, based upon those pictures? I mean, his left eye, you can, he has a crack there,
I mean, that's a little difficult to surmise. I mean, I can't say that he wouldn't be able to see looking at this. You know what I mean? I see the one eye that's open a little bit there. It looks, I can see the pupil, meaning it's clear. You know what I mean? So, so just from an optics standpoint, it's not opacified to the point where he would just be unable to see. You know, so I can't say that he could see, but what I'm saying is that, you know, there's potential there that he could. He is I did notice that on the feet, meaning, you know, at there's some protection on the feet, some sparing, I guess you would say, less burned areas on the front of the ankle, kind of top of the foot area there, which means that was either away from the fire or not doused or somehow covered by something at some point. It was kind of hard, it's hard to say. There's a lot of non-specifics, but I mean that the coverage of the flame is just significant. You know, there's not much in the way of areas involved, and I think, you know, aside from just looking at that little spot on the back of the head, which could imply that he was prone, you know, on something, basically like, for instance, a floor looking up, you know, would put that little area on the back of the head in a, you know, protected area, no oxygen getting there, and less chance to burn, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. But he could also be seated in a seat or against something, a wall, you know, if you're seated against a wall, it could look like that too. So it's just saying something caused a little bit more sparing of the skin and hair in that area relative to everything else around it. But I can't say specifically where he was when that would have occurred, you know?
Sure.
And then you don't know, I mean, the fact that he's got front and back burns, I guess he's moving, you know? These are not any kind of revelations here I'm giving you, you know? Like,
right.
But to get burned on the front and the back means you had to flip over, right? I mean, it's just kind of common sense. And a little bit less injury on the right chest, you know, side
I try to minimally look at, I'm not looking at these pictures right now.
Yeah, so that's probably good.
Please don't forget, the only reason this omission was caught was because I insisted on looking at my own son's autopsy photos. So was it an intentional omission, or was it simply two highly trained professionals who simply dropped the ball? Is it possible that a medical examiner's office is involved in a cover-up and conspiracy to protect a police department? If you can believe Hennepin County's own chief medical examiner's own words, then yes, such corruption does exist. So was it an intentional omission, or was it simply two highly trained professionals who simply dropped the ball? Is it possible that a medical examiner's office would intentionally omit critical evidence in conducting an autopsy? Is it possible that a medical examiner's office is involved in a cover-up and conspiracy to protect a police officer or department? If you can believe Hennepin County's chief medical examiner's own words, then yes, such corruption does exist. In his 2015 address to the American Academy of Forensic Sciences, Dr. Baker acknowledges that, quote, egregious failures of the system have led to tragic consequences for innocent defendants. This includes, quote, overt failings such as incompetence, dishonesty, fraud, and corruption. And let's not forget that the Hennepin County DA, Mike Freeman, was thrown off the George Floyd case because of an inappropriate meeting with Hennepin County Chief Medical Examiner himself, Dr. Andrew Baker. It appears that Mr. Freeman and Mr. Baker were well acquainted. In 2016, Mr. Freeman presented a leadership award to Dr. Baker. So what was it with David's autopsy? Why the blatant omission? Why did Hennepin County do an autopsy in the first place? What was their objective? Was it simply to check another box to make it appear a thorough autopsy had been completed? If the medical examiner's office can remove all of my son's organs and make specific notations about every other aspect of the condition of my son's body, then how could they miss the glaring demarcation on David's wrist if it wasn't a conspiracy? One pathologist omitting the most compelling evidence equals possible error. Two pathologists omitting the most compelling forensic evidence equals conspiracy. If David's autopsy was not an honest legal attempt to get to the truth to how and why he died, then in addition to a conspiracy, this is mutilation of a corpse. Investigating death in which a person died in a most horrific way is a very serious matter. For two pathologists to intentionally omit evidence that would have sent the investigation into a completely different direction would be a criminal offense. I believe justice will be served both here on earth and in the kingdom to come, but we still need your help. If you feel the information presented in this episode warrants a proper investigation by the Department of Justice and the FBI, please do one of the following. Tell your family and friends to listen to the podcast and to sign the petition at change.org. You can call the Department of Justice and the FBI. We had over 41,000 people sign the petition. Imagine if they're all calling the DOJ and the FBI. You can also call your local investigative journalists and tell them about David's story. As I said in the introduction, clearly this is not acceptable conduct by our public officials and law enforcement agencies. When enough people hear about David's tragic story, I believe the proper authorities will have to respond. Thank you for listening.
On the next episode of The Stack Deck.
The real question is, why didn't they allow David to be rescued? Clearly, had this fact been documented, it would have been obvious that David was not, nor could have been, a threat to anyone, especially the well-protected police.
And according to Al Harris, when I talked to him, he said, well, as my understanding, it's a real smoky fire and they couldn't go in there. And when I brought up, no, they told me they believed he was lying in wait, and he seemed to be shocked about that. And then it seems they made a very deliberate effort, and I guess this is somewhat new material that I saw in the Plymouth Fire Department report, where they say, you know, the door was potentially locked, and then they say when the individual exited the apartment, he was immediately checked for weapons. I mean, you've seen David, you know, he was unclad in the condition. That's not something you're going to check him for weapons. And rather than saying, my position is this, and I think it's obvious, rather than saying we made a horrific mistake, they immediately try to justify their poor judgment, and they even planted, we believe conclusively, that they moved a knife and a knife sharpener over by the chair as if this is the reason why.
Thank you for listening. As a listener, I know there's always ways that you want to help. And there's plenty of things you yourself can do if you feel the information presented in this series warrants a proper investigation by the DOJ and the FBI. You can do one or all of the following. First, tell your friends and family to listen to this podcast and sign the petition at change.org. The link for that is in our show notes. You can also call the DOJ at 202-514-2000 and call the FBI at 202-324-2000. 3000. You can also call your local investigative journalist and tell them about David's story. We believe that if enough people hear David's tragic story, the proper authorities will have no choice but to respond. Thank you for listening and for your support.